Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. The true crime story, 10 Minutes Till Midnight, by Lee Martin. Steve Curtis, these murders occurred in your home in the Bonnie Bray section of Denver, Colorado. Thank you for being back in studio. You brought us up to the crime yesterday. Today we'll talk about the trial. But can you reset the stage, the crime scene?
When we left yesterday, I had just described how Kevin Fears had shot me twice in the head, leaving me for dead, stepped over my body, shot Dan Smith twice in the back of the head. And then on the way out the door, the guy they were looking for, my roommate and friend Frank Magnuson, was just coming in. And they shot him twice through the door. And as he fell in the backyard, they shot him four more times. And Frank died as well. After I was certain that they had left and were gone for good, I got up and went into another room and grabbed a telephone. It ended up being the same telephone that they had called Krista Schaefer from.
Who helped arrange the hits with the inmate at the Denver County Jail, Roger Young.
Right, to kill Frank Magnuson, who was the witness to Roger Young's armed robbery trial. And I called 911. This is described in the book. It's a little
astounding. She wouldn't
send the cops.
Accept your call.
Yeah, I was too calm. She didn't believe it. She started reading me the riot act about, you know, don't you know these calls are being taped?
Then you called back, and she was eventually fired.
She was fired for her behavior. They're not taking it seriously. I walked back out into the living room. I had to go into another room to get a different phone because the one that was in the living room was the one they had broken over my head. And as I was walking back out, I stepped over Dan's dead body and just stepped into the kitchen. And out of the corner of my eye, you know, something on the ground caught my eye and I kind of stepped over it. I didn't know what it was. I turned around and looked, and it was about a 5-inch section of his head, the top of his head that had just been blown off, and I almost stepped on it. I walked on out to the back.
There was also a key left in your kitchen.
That key was left on the floor, and that key ended up fitting the front door of Joe Young's home in Northeast Denver. That was part of the evidence linking him to the crime.
Right.
We had other evidence on Kevin Fears linking him to the crime as well. There was a shoe lineup at one point because
you were on the ground.
I was on the ground.
Shot twice in the head.
Right. And just, you know, looking out, just looking straight ahead, I saw Joe Young's shoes. I saw Kevin Fears' shoes. And weeks later, in the basement of the Denver Police Department, because I had described what they were wearing, they had actually taken the shoes off these guys that they were wearing because they had
when
my description
picked
already.
When they them up to interview them, they're wearing the same shoes.
Yeah, they had thrown the clothes away, but they had kept their shoes.
Right.
And so they were,
by the way, gang shoes. BK, I think, British Knights.
Yeah, one of them. Joe Young was wearing like a black referee-type shoe that had, you know, two diamonds on it, and one had a B and one had a K. I didn't understand the significance. I knew BK stood for British Knights, a brand of tennis shoes. I didn't know at that time that the Crips wore BKs and said that it stood for Blood Killer. And of course, the Bloods were their rival gang. But I had described these shoes to the cops, and these guys were wearing shoes like I described to, you know, Fears was wearing Nikes. You know, like tennis shoes, and the other guy, Joe Young, was wearing, and of course I was calling them the big guy and the little guy. I didn't know what their names were.
Right.
And they were wearing the shoes I had described. So in order to identify the shoes, we literally had a shoe lineup. Went to the basement of the Denver Police Department weeks later. They brought out these big plastic bags full of, I believe, I don't know how many pairs of shoes, somewhere in the neighborhood of 40, 50 pairs of shoes or something.
Now that's one part in the book, maybe the only part I would change. Because Lee Martin, the author, takes this from the transcript, 20,000 pages of transcripts he went through.
Right.
And I think he's quoting that wacko defense attorney, Sunwolf, with the monkey paw around her neck. And it's a part of the trial where she's mocking the shoe lineup, and she makes it sound like the only shoes in there were yours and the suspect's.
Right. Well, of course, and that's what they did. I mean, they characterized everything to make it, you know, sound
like something. So what was the shoe lineup
like? The shoe lineup was just a ton of tennis shoes dumped out onto a table, and they just stood back and said, do you recognize any of these shoes? And over the next, like, minute and a half, I pulled out five pairs of shoes, and I said, these are Frank's, these are mine, these are Dan's, this was the big guy, this was the little guy. And I got all five of them right.
Wow, and after you pulled those shoes off the table, was that all the shoes that were on the table, or were there others also?
Oh, no, there were at least several dozen other pairs of shoes still left on the table.
Wow.
But again, remember, I had such a great look at these shoes.
You're on the ground.
They hit me over the head.
Right.
They shot me. Both times I fell to the ground and was looking right at their feet.
Right.
And that impression of what I was seeing just stuck in my head. I remember seeing the little diamond BKs there and going, BK. At the time, didn't mean anything to me, but I just thought that was interesting. I don't think I had ever seen BK tennis shoes before.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we're getting to the trial, really. You set the stage for the crime scene.
Right. And, you know, so I had called the cops. Eventually, the cops showed up. Now, remember, I live five blocks away from a police station, but it's several minutes, probably 10 minutes before the first cop gets to the scene there. I start to describe to the cops what had happened. I'm at the scene for about 20 minutes with them. They finally load me into an ambulance. I've lost a lot of blood. I'm definitely going into shock. It's the middle of summer. I'm starting to freeze. I've lost a lot of blood. They take me down to Denver General Hospital. I'm laying on a table in the operating room, just kind of staring straight up into the bright light that they have in an operating room. And I hadn't said a word at this point. And there's just a team of people. You know, Denver General Hospital, when you arrive there with a gunshot wound to the head, it is an amazing place to see these people just converge on you, and everybody's doing something.
Back then, it's the knife and gun club.
That's what they called it, because
the knife and gun club.
That's where everybody that gets shot or stabbed in the city goes. And they were just an amazing group of people. Very professional. Absolutely knew what they were doing. But as I'm laying there, I'm just staring straight up, and then I just kind of turn my head a little bit and look at the head doctor, and I say, "How's it looking, doc?" And he freaks out because
he thought you're going to die.
They all thought when they got the news, this guy's been shot in the head, and we're bringing him in, and he's lost a lot of blood. They just figure another DOA. This is what he tells me later. But when I said that, he immediately starts barking out orders, and I mean, they went into overdrive. And within about 20 minutes, I'm being wheeled out of there. I've got stitches on two different places in my head. I'm being wheeled out of there into like an observation room. And then the same doctor comes in again, and he's got like a tube and some water and this kind of stuff. And I said, "What's that for?" And he says, "To clean out your arm." And I said, "What?" And because I didn't even realize I'd been shot in the arm at that point.
Now, the book, is it true that he went to squirt some
saline solution, in the back of my arm, in the bullet hole in the back of my arm, and it squirts out the front of my arm like a garden hose.
And we all,
we just all laugh about that because it's weird. I said, "Oh, look, I've sprung a leak." So by this time, I mean, the gravity of what's going on is not only settling in, but also part of that is what I've just been delivered from. Mm. I mean, what I've just made it through, I mean, that is really starting to hit home, too. Mm. So I'm starting to feel a little invincible. You know, my dad walks in. I crack a joke about him being hard-headed and that with his hard head, he doesn't ever have to worry about being shot in the head. He'd be just fine.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So.
And you haven't changed in 20 years. I mean, I know it's funny in the book. Your neighbor, there's 10 cop cars, ambulance. You're covered in blood. Your white clothes are now red. And your neighbor comes out. What was her name?
Stella.
And she says, "Steve, have you been shot?" And you say, "Stella, not now. Go back inside."
Right, yeah. I just kind of barked at her. Go back in your house.
You know? Just cracks me up. You haven't changed, Steve. Okay, so now begins the police, the detectives, the district attorneys, Mike Little, LeCabe?
Al LeCabe, who's now the Denver manager of safety in the Hickenlooper administration, was actually the lead prosecutor on the case. Mike Little, who actually had more seniority than Al, and I thought was really in charge of the case until I read the first manuscript of the book. You know, one thing people don't realize is it's not like on television. When you're a witness – in a trial, you don't sit in the courtroom day in, day out,
right,
listening to everybody else testify.
Right.
You sit
in a
witness room.
So there are months of your life that you're in a witness room.
Months and years. Well, I remember one time I was told I was going to go on at 9 o'clock on Monday morning, and I showed up at 8 o'clock, was sitting in the witness room. And 9 o'clock comes, and 10, and 11, and 1 in the afternoon, and the end of the day, sorry, we can't use you today. So you go home, you show up the next morning at 8 o'clock, and it goes on, 2 weeks, and I never did testify that time.
2 weeks sitting in a witness room.
Just waiting to go on, because, yeah, you know, we had the pretrial hearings. This was a capital murder case. Fears was the defendant, but we also had the Parkside robbery. We had all these different trials, and all these different evidentiary hearings for all these different trials, all kind of simultaneously going on. It's like, you know, you needed a, you know, like a spreadsheet to keep track of which thing was going on what day. And I had to go in and testify to different aspects of all these different things at different times. I was allowed to testify, and it was 100% hearsay. What did Frank Magnuson tell you about the Parkside robbery trial? And of course, the objection was hearsay, and the judge's response to that was, well, of course it's hearsay.
The witness is dead.
Yeah, the witness is dead. Your client had him killed, you know?
Right.
You know, and to see just the boldness of that coming out. And so I was able to testify against Roger Young in the Parkside robbery trial based on what Frank Magnuson had told me. Then all the, you know, the pretrial hearings, you know, getting into the Fears trial.
Steve, it was insanity. Reading the book, now I know from firsthand knowledge the brokenness of our criminal justice system. It's no longer a justice system. Now it's just the system. That's it. Right and wrong, truth, justice. They have nothing to do with it. It's just process.
Right.
And even our Christian leaders approve of legal positivism and process, even against thou shalt not murder. So we're in this Twilight Zone world we live in. But for example, the jury selection went on for the first trial for a month.
Right.
It went on for a month.
Right. Yeah. And that's called voir dire. It's a French word. And it just simply means that they're culling out and deciding. Each side is deciding who they want to stack the jury with.
And I personally am against justice by committee. There's no accountability. If you let murderers go, the jury disbands and that's it. Nobody's responsible. Yeah. But can I read you one statement?
Sure.
This is from the transcripts. Here's one person out of hundreds who were voir dired.
Okay.
I think we've become desensitized in America when a black man does a crime or a black man dies in the street. We expect that to happen. We're outraged when white people die, and because of that, it's easier for people to put a black man to death. No, I'd never vote to kill a black man.
Right.
Now, this is a racist who's hurting blacks far more than whites. Because if the death penalty was only going to be applied to one family in the whole country, I want it applied to my family because it's a deterrent so my kids don't grow up to be murderers. You have a crime epidemic in America, and it's exacerbated in the black community, and it's because of attitudes like this. Blacks kill blacks far more often than they kill whites, and there's a complete meltdown of morality. The prisons are filled with blacks in this country, and it's primarily because the whole system is broken and corrupt.
Well, one of the things, you know, years after this all went on, I debated at law schools with David Lane many, many times. David Lane, famous defense attorney who has actually represented some of our pro-life friends on different things now. But David Lane and I, and actually we became very friendly with each other, but they would make statements, or he would make statements, and I've heard it many times that, you know, a black has such a, in this country has a greater chance of being executed than a white person does. The statistics tell exactly the opposite story, that if you are a white murderer convicted of a capital crime, your chances of getting off death row are far less than those of a black person. Mm. And the reason is that there is this nonsense that, well, first of all, as a crime victim, you really care about the color of the skin of the person that murdered. Of course you couldn't care less.
Right.
You know, I wanted Fears and Young dead because they were murderers. They killed my friends and tried to kill me. They could have been white. They could have been pink. Who cares?
Right.
Who cares? But there's this thing that defense attorneys throw out there, and they throw it out there so often that people actually believe that a black man stands a better chance of being executed for his crime than a white person. And the opposite is true. Mm-hmm. If you're a white man convicted of capital crimes in this country, you are far more likely to be executed than a black man because you don't have the built-in defense that the only reason you're there is because you're black.
Yeah, systemic racism.
Right.
And so anyway, that whole argument hurts blacks, and it lowers the threshold for blacks to become criminals, rapists, murderers. I want the death penalty applicable to my family, to my kids. Somebody who loved blacks, like I do, should want the death penalty applicable to blacks. And if it was applied more frequently to blacks than whites, which it's not, but if it was, that would be merciful to the black community. God was not being rotten or foolish when he mandated the death penalty for every convicted murderer.
You know, I thought about taking a gun into the courtroom. I knew how to do it. I knew how to get around the metal detectors down at the city and county building. I thought about it. I didn't really plan it out. I knew how to do it. I figured it out. And I could have done that. I could have done that. I could have taken a gun in there and exacted justice. I could have done it, timed it for exactly the right moment, made a big deal, probably had a much better ending to the story as far as Hollywood was concerned than what we ended up in real life. But I didn't do it. And the reason I didn't do it is because the law properly applied would be a deterrent against that wrong behavior. And the unfortunate thing is that we have so many ways around the law being a deterrent built into our criminal justice system now.
A lawyer is an expert at the circumvention of the law. That's what, and these defense attorneys in this story, Steve, boy, you want to throw the book at the wall.
Well, they're some of the best in the nation. I mean, when you see guys like David Lane and David Wymore and even Sun Wolf with her wild eccentricities.
She's ended a freak, up, Steve. She's a freak.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have.
She's a freak.
She's something. I mean, you know what? The book is worth reading just to understand that people like this actually live among us, you know? Be afraid. Right. Be very afraid, you know? But it's, I mean, these guys had excellent, excellent representation if the job was to make sure that they didn't get their just punishment, and that's exactly what happened. Mm. You know?
There's a chapter in here called The Trouble with Sunwolf.
Yeah.
There's another chapter, The Total Collapse. This is a page-turner. This is a real, true crime story. But these defense attorneys, their wickedness drips off of the pages.
Yeah.
They are just flat-out evil. They want to obfuscate so that the truth, so that justice is prevented. That is their goal. And when a defense attorney knows that their client raped a woman and murdered her, they do everything they can to obfuscate, distort, or lie, and to get their client acquitted. They are evil. That is evil. They are accomplices after the fact. When they work to get known, clear, obvious rapists and murderers to go free on Judgment Day, God will hold that against them. And they say, I was just doing my job, and God will say, you're an accomplice to rape.
They hold it up like a standard to be worshipped. I mean, you know, this idea of a fair trial is a good idea. This idea of having proper, competent representation is a good idea. I mean, none of us would dispute that. But this idea that to do anything, to put out, just to throw everything up against the wall to see what sticks, you know, even when you know that you're lying, you know that in giving another plausible way that the crime could have happened, you're making the whole thing up. Mm. You don't know if it's plausible. You're making it up. When the evidence points to your client, you know, at that point, well, that's why most of us could not be a defense attorney, because we couldn't live with the lies that kind of come along with being a defense attorney today.
I grew up with a close relative as a defense attorney, one of the most famous ones in New Jersey. He handled mafia cases, murder, rape cases. As a kid in high school, I would get on my bike and go to the courthouse and sit in on murder trials to see, you know, what is this like, criminal justice. And I saw obvious rapists and murderers acquitted because my close relative was a good liar. And he would tell his clients, he would say, I am a better liar than you are. You're caught because you're a fool. You tell me the truth. You tell me what you did, how you did it, and I tell the lies you don't.
Well, he went to college and got a degree in it. That's why he's better at it.
I mean, yeah, that's
you know,
right.
Really, that's how it goes. You know, one thing, too, that I want to make a point is, you know, when you watch Law & Order or CSI or anything, I mean, in 1 hour, you know, with five commercial breaks in between there, you go from the instigation of the crime all the way through to justice. And in real life, we were 4 years in that process.
4 years, which is a separate crime being committed against the victims and against the witnesses.
4 years and only one guy ever stood trial. Only the shooter, Kevin Fears, ever stood trial.
Tell us what happened. So Kevin Fears was found guilty.
Kevin Fears was found guilty, I believe, of 27 felony counts in less than 90 minutes of jury deliberation. There was no question. After 4 years. There was no question. The physical evidence, the circumstantial evidence, the testimony of Krista Schaefer. You know, I was in there testifying that when these guys were on the telephone, from my end, they were saying this. She was saying, and on my end, I was saying this.
Right.
She was saying, yeah, and I heard a guy screaming in the background, and that was Dan Smith. Begging for his life.
Right.
I would say Dan was begging for his life. And she would say, yeah, when they called, I heard this guy in the background begging for his life.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. I would say, I heard Joe Young say, you know, I heard the big guy say this. And she'd say, Joe Young said this to me. And it was the same thing.
Right.
So, I mean, we had these guys cold. We had them cold. Joe Young's key to his front door is right there.
Right.
I mean, on my floor. I didn't know Joe Young. How did Joe Young's key get in my house?
And murderers are bad problem solvers, and the guy is a rocket scientist. We know that, so he leaves evidence behind.
Well, yeah, and they're screaming out of the alley in their car, and they hit a telephone pole and some brown paint, you know, or red paint gets on the telephone pole,
right.
and sure enough, the cops find that on the telephone pole, and they match it up to the car that these guys have. So
Kevin Fears is convicted because there is a mountain of evidence.
Yeah, and we go to the penalty phase of the trial, and suddenly it's, you know, these same defense attorneys that just days earlier were saying, he's not guilty, he didn't do this crime. These guys are racially motivated, are saying, look, we know he did it, we all know he did it, and it was a horrible thing to do, but
it's not his fault.
It's not his fault because his mother drank.
He's mildly retarded.
He's mildly retarded. And when you read his statement that he gives to the court, you understand this guy was not mildly retarded. Mm. This guy was not uneducated. Mm. You know, this guy was black. Other than that, there's not a shred of truth to everything they're saying.
Mm.
You know, not a shred of truth to everything they're saying. The fact that he was black is undisputable, but he was not retarded. He did not suffer from fetal alcohol syndrome. He was eloquent in his defense of his own life.
Right.
Admitting what he did and then recanting and admitting again.
Yeah, he admitted it. Then he recanted. Then he's trying to cut a deal in the sentencing phase.
Yeah. Trying to save his own skin. And guess what? He's successful.
He's successful because he got life in prison.
Yeah, because you know what? Because the defense attorneys look right at those jurors. They pick out the ones they think they can get. They look that lady right in the eye and they say, if you kill, you know, they put a picture
They talk about murder. They use the word murder.
Yeah.
How are you going to live with murdering this young man?
Right. And they show a picture.
That is so evil.
Yeah, they show a picture of Kevin Fears' young child and they say, you know, this, or Kevin Fears as a young child, and then say that he also has children. And if you murder him, you're guilty of doing the same thing to his children as he did to the Magnuson's children.
They show the picture of Kevin Fears, this family picture. Mm-hmm. They objected during the trial to a photograph of Frank Magnuson being shown to the jury. They said that's prejudicial because he looks happy with his family.
Yeah, but,
I mean, how despicable can you get?
Yeah, but they've got this picture of Kevin at like 7 years old or something, just smiling, cute kid, wearing, you know.
Prosecutor should not have settled, and they did, and they withdrew the death penalty. So he got life in prison.
Yeah, he got life in prison. He got two life sentences plus 144 years. Mm. Based on that, Roger Young, who set the whole thing up from jail. Now, think about this. Roger Young, who we can prove was not there because he was in jail at the time, pleads out to two life sentences and 112 years.
All right.
Okay. Joe Young, The more violent of the two guys in the house right up to the moment of the shooting, the guy directing Kevin Fear's movements, the guy that's barking out the orders, the guy that's stomping on my head, the guy that's doing all this, gets pled out weeks later. And I don't even find out about this until the Rocky Mountain News reporter knocks on my door one night. And I answer it, and she says, "We want to know what your reaction to the plea bargain is." And I said, "What plea bargain?"
Wow.
I find out from a newspaper reporter that it's a done deal.
That
Joe Young was sentenced to one count of conspiracy to commit murder.
Oh, no.
24 years. He was given 4.5 years for time already served.
So that's 20 years, and you get half off about.
Yeah, so he ended up doing 19 years.
He was released...
I think August of 2008, if I remember
last
yeah,
summer.
Over a year ago now.
You called me when that happened,
right?
And you said Joe Young is out.
Yeah, he's walking the streets of
The streets.
We don't know where.
Kevin Fears is not walking the streets.
Kevin Fears committed suicide in prison back in 2006. Kevin Fears left a note. We were told that he had finally admitted or come to terms with what he had done. We also understand that in jail he'd become a Muslim, and so that is unfortunate.
He went to be with Muhammad. Is in hell.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I guess there's justice, you know. But Kevin Fears finally admitted it, and we understand that in his note, basically said that he was now going to do to himself what the system should have done to him. Years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew that. And we talked, we talked several days ago in one of the first shows that we did about how even these evil criminals know right from wrong.
Yeah, when he went to execute you on your back porch and the gun jammed, misfired, and he said, "That was God. I just tried to kill you."
Right. And so he knew. And he knew what should have happened to him because he understood the gravity of his crime. He had killed two innocent men. And as far as he knew when he left that night, he had murdered three.
And so the one guy left in jail still is Roger Young, the one guy who wasn't there.
Isn't that amazing?
He called the shots.
Yeah.
It was his murders.
Yeah, and he wasn't there, and he's the only one serving time today.
Steve Curtis, thanks for telling this story and joining us in studio. The book is 10 Minutes Till Midnight by Lee Martin. And, Steve, we're making this available at our website.
Yeah, just go to kgov.com, order it directly from Bob Enyart Live. You're helping to support, this radio show and keeping it on the air. And you won't be disappointed in the book. It is a good read. It's a very good read.
And I'll also say, for those who want us to stay on the air, if you call up and give a $50 donation to Bob Enyart Live and ask for the book, 10 Minutes Till Midnight, we'll send it to you as a thank you. Our number, 800-8-ENYART. 800-836-9278. Again, Steve, it's been great having you in studio. Thanks.
Nice to be here, Bob. Thank you.
In Arvada, Colorado, Maranatha Christian Center. What a great school, Maranatha. And this is Bob Enyart Live. May God bless you. Right.